If by the end of this, you're still not done with me, I will be sharing some pictures and kind of concrete stories about my time at the border in Texas, and Anna will as well during second hour. So this morning during this sermon reflection, I'd like to reflect more on borders and some kind of theological thinking about borders and tell you a little bit about my time. At the beginning of October, while you celebrated World Communion Sunday here in Goshen, I celebrated with a group of pastors, as I told you, at the U.S.-Mexico border. We shared communion with each other at a bird sanctuary. The day before, we'd driven from San Antonio almost 4 hours to McAllen, Texas. And there we gathered to share a most ecumenical communion with the birds and the wall. The day before, in San Antonio, we began our time with the tour of the Alamo, that iconic place of battle. Now, I'm going to blame my Canadian upbringing, but I did not know anything about the Alamo. Though in Parks and Rec, there's one episode where they say, "Remember the Alamo!" I'm sure it's said other places, but that's my context for that place prior to the battle. So I learned some important American history. I learned that Davy Crockett was a real person. I didn't know that. I had put him in the category of myth, like Paul Bunyan. But in addition to that important fact about Davy Crockett, I learned a number of other important things. We walked around the Alamo and listened to the untold stories of that place, the stories of those who are often left out of history. As we did this morning, we heard the voices of the Native Americans. We heard the voices of those who we were told, "You might not hear these voices at the border." And we were left to wonder, why were they missing? Were they not physically present? Are they not allowed to be present in that space? Were they dead? And as we walked around the Alamo, we stopped at different locations and heard the stories. When we stopped in front of the Menger Hotel on Crockett Street, just across from the Alamo, this is what we heard from artist and theologian Mark Fowler.
The Menger has the claim of being the most haunted hotel in Texas. Who haunts this place? Local legends tell of many varied ghosts, from President Theodore Roosevelt to Sally White, a hotel chambermaid. But perhaps there are other unnamed ghosts here, too. Apart from the Texian dead remembered by the cenotaph, there are several hundred Mexican soldiers who also died at the famous battle. Their presence haunts this space. These days, the Alamo is in essence a shrine to the fallen. But from centuries past, before the Spanish even arrived, this site was haunted by the graves of Indian peoples. It is a very old and sacred Native American burial site. As the U.S. increasingly forced Native American populations into marginal land over the course of the 19th century, the ghost dance became a ritual in the resistance against colonial oppression. It was a means to invoke the spirits of the dead to aid the just cause of the living, and the haunted hotel evokes that same memory from this contested site of remembrance. The infamous massacre at Wounded Knee in South Dakota was triggered by the reaction of U.S. forces to the ghost dance. The specter of the dead who demand justice can terrorize the living. This hotel unexpectedly uncovers the unpredictability of the Alamo and the questions over justice which still haunt the space today.
Across the Alamo, on the other side, there stands another hotel, the Emily Morgan Hotel. Hear this story of Emily Morgan.
The legend of Emily Morgan, after whom this hotel was named, is a little historically shaky. But the story goes, and stories are often more powerful than fact, that Emily Morgan was originally Emily West, a mixed-race indentured servant to a James Morgan of New York, who sent her to work for a year in his new San Antonio hotel. While here, she was captured by the Mexican army and forced to travel with them across Texas. When the Texian army arrived at Jacinto for what would be the decisive last battle of the revolution, the Mexican president, Santa Anna, was caught unprepared because he was otherwise engaged in bed with Emily West. As a result, Emily West became a local legend and associated with the song The Yellow Rose of Texas. But the story evokes some of the complexities of the Alamo and the struggles that surround it. The Texian Revolution was racially charged in several different ways.
Firstly, the influx of white American colonists changed the population of Texas and fueled its rebellion against Mexico. In the new Republic of Texas, Tejanos did not enjoy the power that whites achieved. The revolution was also supported by the southern states because, in Mexico, slavery was illegal. Once the revolution was over, Emily West, a formerly free woman from Connecticut, was automatically regarded as property, her papers having been lost in her capture. The celebrated myth of her role in Texas's independence masks the reality of the profound change that occurred for Texan people of color. Emily West is known here as Emily Morgan, her bond's name after all.
It is not just Mexican or African-American stories that insist on being heard by this hotel. Finding Emily West in bed with Santa Anna evokes the Mexican president's strong words, quote, "We have failed because of our deplorable racial mixture, and the responsibility for this sad state of affairs lies with the Spanish missionaries who saved the Indian from extinction," unquote. The native peoples of the land suffered both from the Spanish, then Mexican, powers, and then later from the insurgent white American colonists of the new Texan Republic. The story of the ancient peoples of the land is almost entirely erased. This hotel unexpectedly uncovers the complexity of the Alamo and the contest over whose stories are told here today.
Hearing these untold stories made me wonder, what are the stories in my town? What are the stories of this space? What are the stories of the house that I live in? Where are there borders that I am unaware of? Where are there spaces that were sacred for some, and maybe now, like the Alamo, still sacred for others? Carrying these questions with me at the beginning of the trip left me wondering, how can I ask better questions of the borders in my own spaces, in my own town? It made me think and think again about the way that places and spaces are deeply impacted by the bodies that are present and impacted by the bodies that are absent. Because we need to remember that depending on your body, you are more welcome in some spaces than others. So I began to look as we traveled south, who are the bodies that we're coming in contact with? Who are the bodies that are missing? And it's something that I've wondered as I've returned home here. This Sunday before Thanksgiving, I'm especially aware of the way that we tell these stories of Thanksgiving and the way that the stories do not include First Nations or Indigenous people in the areas that we are living, especially in school, especially in elementary school and preschool, where it's much easier to just talk about pilgrims and Indians. It's really troubling. And as I was thinking about this service and my time at the border, it was really important to me to have Ira and Thomas and Ellie to participate in this service the same way that they did on their pilgrimage tour. They did a job of naming voices that aren't usually named in Thanksgiving. They, and hopefully other fourth graders in their Indiana history, are learning about the Potawatomi that were forced to leave the land, and they were learning about those who participated in the removal, I went on that pilgrimage trip, and they read from the journal of some of the people who forced the removal. These fourth graders, on their pilgrimage, went to the first five historical markers along the Trail of Death that are in Indiana. While we were there, I learned that it was a child who began the education of the adults around him about the Trail of Death. It was a child who worked to have the first historical marker placed in Indiana. There are now over 80 markers between here and Kansas. So these children and others are part of an important group that is naming and calling on the ghosts of our collective space. In their pilgrimage, they were not only learning about, but giving power to the voices of the past, and then modeling with that lament. They also sang, "O Lord, have mercy," and "Healing River," as they said. They were then modeling lament and grief and justice and reconciliation. There is a concept in ecology called an ecotone, and there are some people who can probably say more about this in an ecological way than I, but I'm going to use it as a theological metaphor. So first, it's an area between two biomes. It's where two communities meet and integrate. It can be narrow or wide. It can be local or regional. An ecotone may appear on the ground as a gradual blending of two communities across a broad area, or it can manifest itself as a sharp boundary line. No matter what, it's a border. And in this border zone, there's a crossing of boundaries of creatures and plants and animals from each unique biome into the other. They cross boundaries. And in that in-between space, there's incredible diversity. The ecotone is full of life. Let's imagine that as life at the border. Imagine the places in your life where you have a border, where two different things are coming together. While I was in South Texas, I learned of a human ecotone, I'm going to call it that, that I didn't know about. There's the U.S. border that we know about, that is between the U.S. and Mexico. And about 50 miles north of that border, there are a series of checkpoints that look just like border crossing stations. I didn't know about these checkpoints. These are not temporary checkpoints, like by little vans or something. They are buildings with cameras and scanning devices and border patrol staff 50 miles north of the border. Okay? Their physical barrier is in addition to the myriad of electronic surveillance devices that exist in this whole ecotone zone. And there are people, many people primarily from Mexico, who cross the U.S. border and then remain because they can't make it through this series of checkpoints. They stay in the zone between border and checkpoint, never leaving the Rio Grande Valley. And these folks are part of the fabric of the community. They are the community. And yet their stories in the public news are not things that we hear. I had never heard of this zone. Their bodies are not the ones we see because they cannot leave that zone. They are bound by the boundaries that we have created with fear and policy and infrastructure. One of the things that was the most terrifying to me was when I learned that you can enter this zone, enter this ecotone from the north without knowledge that you're going there. I had this like terrible thought on the way back, like, what if we took a service group of kids and we had an undocumented one? We crossed the border going south and we didn't know that this existed. We couldn't cross back north. Because when you're going south, you don't see those checkpoints. It's just a highway with a wide meridian in the middle, a wide median in the middle. It doesn't allow you to see that you're passing a buildup of border enforcement. The only way that you might know that you've entered the zone is if you're on your phone, because it will stop working. You enter a zone controlled by enforcers, and then you drive out of that border checkpoint area, and your phone starts to work again. It is invisible to those with privilege, but all too well known to those whose bodies are being enforced. But the bodies that move in contested spaces, by their very presence, are challenging the systems of control that seek to contain them. This enforcement is a forceful answer to our national uncertainty. But when we can see it, when we recognize it and can ask questions about it, I think those questions hold their own power. So our job, then, is to look for stories on the border of our congregation and our community, the stories on the borders of ourselves, the stories that are not spoken, the stories told only in secret, the stories that don't recognize the bodies that are not present, or the stories that do recognize the bodies that are not present in this space. There is a richness in these borders, a richness in these ecotones, because they're inhabited by people from different spaces. And I hope that when we remember our past, in Egypt, we were slaves. We were once the persecuted minority. When we remember our past, the present and those absent is illuminated in new ways. We can hear the complexity in this room and in ourselves and celebrate the gift of community that we've given. And our celebration can reach beyond these walls, beyond time, and celebrate the multiplicity of voices we hear. As we gather at our Thanksgiving tables and at this table of bread, let us recognize the borders that we live with in our family and community. Let us turn to the Beatitudes, for this is a text of hope and grief. I want to read the Beatitudes to you as we read it in Texas as an invocation for ghosts, an invocation for those bodies of the Potawatomi, for the black and brown bodies, an invocation for the bodies that our country and our town and our stories silence and remove. I want to read it as we remember all the saints, all the stories, all of the bodies that are gathered together of hope and confession. Here come the depressed. They own the future. Here come the grieving. They will be comforted. Here come the enslaved. They will have the whole earth. Here come the ones who are starved of justice. They will be filled. Here come the gracious. They will be shown grace. Here come the uncorrupted. They will see God. Here come the peacemakers. They will be protected. Here come the oppressed. They own the future. Here you come, you wrongly accused. Take heart. They did this to your heroes who will not die. Amen.